Okay, good evening everyone. It's good to see you again. Thank you to the Rothschilds for opening up your home for this evening's lecture. Greatly appreciated. So this evening is part two of a three-part series that we are calling the Making of Modern Judaism. And last time we spoke about the rise of the Reform Movement. Today our topic is the origins of ultra-Orthodoxy, and next week, same time, same place, right, Charlie?
Yes.
Same time, same place. We'll be in Antifrost next week. We really won't be home.
Next week, same time, same place, we'll be discussing the legacy of Rav Hirsch and the rise of what is known as Neo-Orthodox Judaism. In a few moments, we'll kind of recap where we started last time, for those who were not here, give a brief history of the salient pieces of the rise of the Reform Movement, because it's important for telling the story that we're going to tell today. But I want to start with the following. I once gave this lecture series, not as a three-part lecture series, but as a two-part lecture series, just what we're calling parts two and parts three, as sort of a standalone series, and I called the series The Origins of Orthodoxy. And I got a question very early on in my lecture from actually a YUCB student who was bothered by the title, The Origins of Orthodoxy. And his question was, back then I was known as Professor Pearl, but Professor, weren't we always Orthodox? Weren't we always Orthodox? So I put that question out to you. Is there validity in talking about the origins of Orthodoxy, or were we always Orthodox? What do you think?
My father always said in Europe, the Judaism that people didn't observe, not everyone was observant, but everyone was Orthodox.
Not everyone was observant, but everyone was Orthodox. And what they meant by that was?
That whatever they did would have been Orthodox, and they chose not to do it. But no one considered themselves anything but Orthodox. They just chose not to keep Shabbos, or they chose not to keep kosher. But they were Orthodox.
If they would have, it would have been an Orthodox way.
Okay, you know,
Israelis, the shul they go to is an Orthodox shul.
So their values and belief system were aligned with Orthodoxy, even if their practice didn't necessarily reflect that. Okay. Anybody else?
There's one Shulchan Aruch, and that was everybody followed it, whether you kind of on the same line. If you choose to follow it, fine, but there were no deviations from that.
Yeah, no one said there was a different set of rules. They just chose not to follow the rules.
Okay.
Well, you could go back far enough in history that Sadducees rejected oral law, so they had a different stream of Judaism altogether.
Okay, so we definitely do have a history of denominations that go well farther back into our history. Okay, that's a good argument. So again, the question for those who just joined us, and welcome, and there should be enough sheets to go around. Where are the extra sheets? On the table over there? Okay, great. The question is, were we always Orthodox? That is, I preface it by saying I give a lecture series once that was focused just on today's lecture or next week's lecture. I called it The Origins of Orthodoxy, and I got some pretty stiff pushback from those who argued that there's nothing to lecture about the origins of Orthodoxy. The origins of Orthodoxy was Mount Har Sinai, right? That's when Orthodoxy began. And I'd like to suggest that, at least from the historical perspective, that that's not the case. That there is validity to talking about the origins of Orthodoxy, and I want to clarify what I mean by that. One of the great historians of the Jewish community, social historian of the Jewish community in the 20th century, was a man by the name of Jacob Katz. Jacob Katz offered a lot to the world of scholarship. In particular, he was one of the first to really use his very strong background in rabbinical texts to mine Tshuvot and other rabbinical halachic texts for their historical value. Jacob Katz made the following argument. He said that there is a difference between being traditional and being traditionalist. And that prior to the 19th century, it is true, Jews were traditional, with exception of some denominations, right? If we go far enough back. But what changed in the 19th century is that Jews went from those who continued to practice, or even if they didn't practice, continued to affiliate with the Orthodox community, switched from being traditional to traditionalist. What do you think he meant by that?
Partly they're defining themselves with reference to the people who were rejected. But could we say that about prior periods of history where...
Okay. No, go ahead. Hey, yes. What do you mean?
Well, I think that there were other times in history where it seemed to people at that time that our tradition was being questioned, and they wanted to make sure to stay in line with themselves.
What period of history are you referring to?
I'm not the same. I can't do this.
You're absolutely right. There were other challenges. I mean, early Christians were a great example. Certainly, Sadducees are an example, and there were others. But the point that Katz was trying to make, and I think it's an important one for understanding our topic today, is that beginning in the 19th century, and we're going to go through the emergence of this story, what changes, and it's a slight change, but it's a really important change. It is this move from traditional Judaism to traditionalist Judaism. Traditionalist Judaism meaning that there is, that I'm defining myself, my belief set, my values are such that I believe in being traditional. It's a conscious decision to be traditional rather than follow these other emerging streams within the Jewish world. And that conscious decision has consequences, has ripple effects in the way in which the traditional community observes. That is, in the decisions that I make now, I'm making with a conscious sense of an other. There's somebody who I'm defining myself against. Right? And that doesn't only shape the history of this group, the divergent group, but it shapes the history of the group that defines itself against the other as well. So on the sheets that I've handed out is a color-coded timeline. The timeline has four different colors on it. There's sort of the gray that's got the two bars on either side. Those are major events in Western European history that impact the course of Jewish history, but aren't actually events within the Jewish community themselves. The green are major events in the rise of the Reform Movement. The red are the major events in the rise of what we would call the ultra-Orthodox movement, and blue refers to those events that shape the story of the rise of neo-Orthodox Judaism. And so the first thing that I want you to notice by just looking at this pretty design that I put on the sheet is how intertwined these three stories are. They're happening at the same time, in the same place, and so therefore their stories need to be told together. Because one impacts the other, one leaves a footprint on the other. So the story we told last time was the story of Reform Judaism. And we said as follows. We said that Reform Judaism can really be talked about in three emergent stages. The first is that of the late 18th into the 19th century, a period we referred to as the rise of aesthetic and educational reform. That is, as a result of the Haskalah, Jewish Enlightenment, in Western Europe, you begin to have Jews who are educated in a different way, thinking in a different way, begin to start schools that have a more modern bent on them. These schools often open shuls. We read a description of the first, what is known as the first Reformed Temple, the Temple of Isaac Jacobson in Seesen, Westphalia, which was the outgrowth of the school that he had made. And we said that the first reforms that appear in these shuls are of an aesthetic nature, right? What were some of the things we described?
Organs.
Or an organ in the shul, but played by a non-Jew. Okay, what else?
The robes and the processional.
Exactly. They were wearing canonicals, the robes of priests. There were processions. What were they most fixated on? What was the most important thing about what's going to happen in the shul? Decorum. Right, decorum was the most important thing. So choirs, Robes, organs played by non-Jews, beautiful spaces. They changed the pronunciation of the Hebrew from the Ashkenazis pronunciation to a Sfaradit pronunciation. All of these being, they introduced a sermon in German, right? And a few tefillot that they wanted to say in German as well. All of these changes leading up to 1818 were all defended or justified on halachic grounds, at least within their community. They offered halachic grounding for the changes they were making, and for the most part, they were focused on creating a different aesthetic experience inside the world of the shul. And we said this was prompted by two different things, which will run the gamut of the rise of the Reform movement. On the one hand, there was a very real sense that Western European Jews living post-French Revolution felt themselves in a different world. The world had changed around them. These were new, enlightened, modern young men and women for whom Judaism was old and it was stale and it didn't speak to them. To be inspired in that world was to hear a beautiful choir sing, was to hear the music of the organ. When they walked into a shul, they got none of that. And so there was a very genuine sense among some to feel reconnected to Judaism in this post-French revolutionary world. And then there was another motivation we spoke about, which was this glimpse of emancipation that Jews in Western Europe felt as Napoleon came and conquered Europe and brought with it freedoms that Jews had never known before. And then after his failed invasion of Russia, Napoleon gets swept back, as do the freedoms that Jews enjoyed in Europe, leaving an urgency and a sense amongst Western European Jews that if only they could convince their surrounding neighbors that they were deserving of full-fledged citizenship. If only other people didn't look down on Jews, but looked up at Jews, or at least saw them as their equal, then perhaps full emancipation would come. And these two things result in the changes that we see in the early Reform movement. That leads us to 1818. 1818 is often seen as the watershed moment in the development of the Reform movement, and historians also point to 1818 as the birth of, some would say, Orthodoxy, some would say, ultra-Orthodoxy. What happens in 1818? In 1818, this group in Hamburg gets together and starts the New Israelite Temple Association in an attempt to start a synagogue not that different than the ones that had been started in Berlin before it, but to start a synagogue that was going to have an organ played by a non-Jew, that was going to have a slightly different sitter that had taken some tefillot out and put some in German. They were going to have canonicals. They were going to have a sermon that was said in German. The Hamburg Temple, the idea behind the Hamburg Temple, elicited quite a response from the Jewish community, which we're going to look at this evening. The rest of the story that we told was that post-1818, things begin to shift in the Reform movement. Europe actually sees a rise in reactionary, more conservative governments in the wake of Napoleon, who are actually not very friendly to these reformers. Reformers of any sort are not looked upon favorably by the Western Europe, by the German Prussian governments in the first half of the 19th century. Following, though, the 1840s, we begin to see a series of reform rabbinical conferences that these rabbis were heading these independent grassroots efforts come together in the 1840s. They run a series of rabbinical conferences. They begin to align themselves. That's when they begin to say, to sort of throw off the yoke to some degree of halacha as a binding legal system, and rather see it as a repository of Jewish values, which are supposed to be amended for the times. Following the 1840s into the second half of the 19th century is when the Reform movement comes into its own, and we noted that at the same time as this was developing in the German lands, a smaller but ultimately more impactful. A system was developing here on the shores of the United States, particularly in and around South Carolina. And Charleston really seemed to be the centerpiece of it. And what they were doing was mimicking exactly what was happening in Western Europe at the time. And then ultimately, it was in 1885 with the passing of the Pittsburgh Platform that sets out the basic ideas of Reform Judaism and paved the way for the development of Reform here in the United States. There was a question?
I meant to ask this last week. So until this point, at least using synagogue as the example, the service, yes, it had some German, but it was still the same. It had the same whatever they were doing Musaf. They were doing Musaf. They didn't cut anything.
In the Hamburg temple. So first of all, as I mentioned last time, they returned to the triennial cycle of laning, right, which shortens the laning considerably. So they certainly did that. They also took out any references to Shivat Zion, right? They took out. Some just with a slight emendation, right, referencing tefillah instead of, you know, our areshet sifateinu instead of our korbanot chavoteinu, and some of it were slightly larger deletions. And again, why was that important to them that they take out any reference to a Shivat Zion, to going back to Israel? Right, because so much of what was pushing this was the desire for emancipation, right, for full-fledged citizenship in Western Europe. And like we said last time, hard to argue that you should accept me as a citizen when three times a day I stand up and say, God, take me back to Israel. Right? So those were one of the first things, right, that went. Okay, so let's look today then at the responses to the Hamburg Temple controversy and then its aftermath. So on the title that you have, I wrote in 1819, I wrote the words Eile Divrei Habrit. So Eile Divrei Habrit refers to a compendium of tshuvot that were written and published in 1819 in response to the tshuvot that had been written defending the practices of the Hamburg Temple. Right? That is, up until 1818, as these new reforms were emerging, the leaders of these shuls continued to look particularly to two people, in particular, a guy by the name of Rabbi Eliezer Lieberman and the person by the name of Rabbi Aaron Chorin, right, as people who could defend the practices that they were doing on halakhic ground. The Hamburg Beit Din felt like they needed to bring in the big guns, right, to show that this, in fact, was not legitimate practice, not authentic practice within the Jewish community. And so they sent letters out to the Gedolim of Western Europe and Central Europe, asking them to please write tshuvot in response to these issues. So on the right-hand side, on the top of page 2, you see the title page from Eile Divrei Habrit, and rather than retyping this, I want to show it to you in its original. And you can see that there were three issues, right, at hand in this compendium. There were three things that they sent out to these rabbis and asked them to please write tshuvot on. The first one is Asur l'shanot seder ha'tefila ha'nahuga b'Yisrael mi'birchot ha'shachar ad achar alinu l'shaveach mi'kol shekein she'ein ligro mimena. Right, so it's forbidden to change the customary prayer service from the morning benedictions, from the brachot in the morning until after aleinu, and certainly forbidden to delete anything from them. But asur lihipalel seder tefillah halaz bilashon acher chutz bilashon hakodesh v'chol tefillah hanipeset shelo betkuna v'shelo b'minhagenu hi psula v'asur lihipalel mitocha. It is forbidden to recite our tefillot in any language other than Hebrew. And any prayer printed improperly or in a manner against our custom is invalid, and it is forbidden to pray from it. And number 3, asur l'nagein b'beit ha'kneset b'shum kli shir b'shabbat b'yom tov afilu al yidei eno Yisrael. It is forbidden for any musical instrument to be played in the synagogue on Shabbat and Yom Tov, even by a non-Jew. These were the three issues they asked the Gedolim to write responses to. Now, out of curiosity, which of these three would you say is the hardest to defend halachically? I heard two and threes. Lashon HaKodesh. That would be number two. Right? Why?
The Mishnah says you could pray in any language and recite Shema in any language.
Right. Slight challenge there. Right? And the Mishnah says, Tfilah b'chol lashon hi. Right? Tfilah can be said, davening can be done in any language. Those of you who said three said it why?
Because if the non-Jews play music.
Okay. Right. So certainly three is requires some sort of explanation. But yes, two is the hardest one from a halachic perspective. Right? Not only does the Mishnah say that, but we actually practice it. Right? What tefillot do we say that are not in Hebrew?
The Kaddish.
Kaddish is a good example. Right? Kaddish is Aramaic. Brich Shemay is an Aramaic. Yikum Purkun is an Aramaic. Right? So that was a hard one. Okay, good. So what I've given you afterwards is some selections from some of the tshuvot that were written as part of this compilation, and I want to read them because I want you to get a feel, right, for what these sounded like, and get a sense for how the community was feeling, right, in response to these new synagogues. What can I say? What can I tell? Get up, my brothers. Let us pray and ask of God that He give these men the strength to abandon their path. I'm on the bottom of page 2. And to rise up on the path toward the house of God, and to return and remember, and to strengthen the customs of their fathers, for the customs of Israel are Torah. Then there will be peace over Israel, and God will mend the breaches, and the Redeemer will come to Zion. And likewise, it is forbidden to change any set custom, and not just those mentioned in the Talmud and practiced by all, but even those of specific regions and of individual congregations that have been accepted for generations. And this man, Rabbi Aaron Chorin, we know him, and he knows nothing about Talmud or Halacha, and heaven forbid that we rely on his ruling. It is clear that they are heretics in the foundations of our religion and faith, and in the words of the holy prophets. Let's stop there for a second. Let's focus for a second on Numbers 2, and less so number 3, but let's focus on number 2. If the Hamburg Beis Din is asking these Gedolim to write in defense of their position that this cannot happen, it cannot be allowed, and yet a simple reading of the halacha would suggest that it could, so what alternatives do you have as a posek in that time? Where do you go if you're in that kind of quandary? That is, you know, and you agree with the Hamburg Beis Din, we can't allow this to happen. So what are your choices? How might you assert such a thing, prohibit such a thing, if not on strictly halachic grounds?
Mesorah.
Huh? Okay. Okay, the spirit of the law? You mean you go to Mesorah? We have tradition that it goes beyond, right, the letter of the law. This is the way we've been doing it, and therefore we need to continue doing it. What else might we say?
Slippery slope.
Okay, the slippery slope argument, right? That, okay, so yes, this might not be so bad, right, but where it leads to, right, that's going to be the real trouble, and therefore we've got to cut it off at the knees now, lest it become something more. So this is the position that many of these posts can find themselves in, right? Knowing that the answer has to be that we can't allow this, right? But having to resort to what we might call these extra legal, right, approaches in order to try and make that point. So let's continue reading.
They also go ad hominem a little bit.
Right? Okay, right. Or go after the people, right? Go ad hominem and talk about, you know, the people who have put their names behind this suggestion and, you know, defame them, right, so that it doesn't stand. Okay, in the house of the wicked, on the top of page 3, the house of the wicked shall be destroyed, and the right hand of the wicked you shall break. And I pray to the living God that He should send His messenger before you to push back those who rise to uproot the foundational principles of our religion, to save you from any evil in the future. My brothers, praised is your lot. You are blessed to God, because you have girded yourselves to fight the battle of the glorious God. And I pray to the living God that He should awaken His mercy and kindness to overturn the hearts of the mistaken ones, so that they listen to the voices of their teachers, and so that those whose spirit is flawed will become enlightened. This is from Gedalia Tikhtin, who again was one of the great Gedolim of Western Europe at the time. You can hear the language, right? What does the language suggest? What are they feeling?
Behala.
They're overwhelmed. They're
overwrought.
They're nervous.
Huh? Overwrought. It's really harsh language.
It's very harsh language. They're in the midst. They see this as a battle.
As a threat, right?
The threat they see. Right? This had been developing in small stages, a little bit here, a little bit there. By 1818, they're feeling the weight, right? That this is something that's really dangerous. And the language that they're using, this is not the language you would use in a tshuva. Yes, you can do it, you can't do it. Mutzer aser. Right? That's not the language that we see here at all.
They're answering in Hebrew. I mean, these people are saying we don't understand Hebrew. That's why we want to...
Well, they're not running to those people. No. This is the Hamburg Beit Din, right? That's sent out to these other Gedolim asking for additional firepower. Okay. The person, though, right, who emerges as most influential in the opposition of the Reform movement, and as its most vocal opponent, is a man by the name of Rav Moshe Sofer, known to us as the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer, I believe I have it here on your sheet. I wrote, if you look in the top of the timeline, 1790 to 1817, I wrote the emergence of Rav Moshe Sofer. He takes a series of smaller rabbinic positions until by 1817 he's pretty firmly established. He's the rabbi in a city in Hungary called Pressburg, today known as Bratislava. He has started a yeshiva there. He also has a very famous father-in-law. He's remarried now for his second time. His father-in-law is the preeminent posek gadol hador of Western and Central Europe at the time, and that was, I mentioned it last time, I don't remember, who is his father-in-law? His father-in-law was Rabbi Akiva Eger. So he is the son-in-law of Rabbi Akiva Eger. He is a tremendous Talmud Chacham in his own right. And he is also a tremendously talented writer. And his words, his way, his use of language throughout his tshuvot is powerful, it's witty, it's clever, and it's no surprise then that there's this combination of a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and everybody recognized, right, his abilities as a Talmud Chacham, as it were, and his ability to communicate and express his ideas in ways that were pithy, that were memorable. It's almost like, you know, the sound bites of today, right? Today all we hear are sound bites or tweets. Right? So he had a way with those small phrases that were memorable and could catch your attention. And it's one of those sound bites that Chassam Sofer is probably best known for. And so I thought we would take a little bit of time to look at that today and perhaps understand a more nuanced fashion what the Chassam Sofer meant by this. And ultimately, you know, what impact it had. So the Chassam Sofer, if you read a traditional history of this period, so it'll say that the Reform movement begins to rise in the first half of the 19th century, and the great opposer of the Reform movement emerges in Rabbi Moses Sofer, whose call to arms was what? His slogan was, Hechadash Asur Min HaTorah. Hachadash asur min haTorah, which means anything that is new is prohibited from the Torah. Anything that's new. And from Rabbi Moshe Sofer, and this attitude of Hachadash asur min haTorah emerges what today we know as ultra-Orthodoxy. That is a segment within Orthodoxy that opposes any and all changes to Jewish life, regardless of whether it's halachic or not halachic, following the footsteps of the Chassam Sofer. Okay, let's check our facts a little bit on this, and perhaps modify that story just a little bit. So it is true, the Chassam Sofer uses this phrase, I believe, five different times, in five different tshuvot. He uses this phrase, Hachadash Asur Min HaTorah. So the first thing you need to know is what I said just a moment ago, and I think it's worth reiterating. Chassam Sofer had lots of slogans. One of them was Ubnei Yisrael Yotzim Biyad Rama. Okay, now what does that mean? Ubnei Yisrael Yotzim Biyad Rama.
And that was an uplifted hand.
Okay, so the Jewish people went out of Mitzrayim with an uplifted, with God's right uplifted hand, Biyad Rama. Chassam Sofer uses it, right, to reference the fact when there's a machlokes between the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, Ubnei Yisrael Yotzin Biyad Ramah, we always follow the Ramah in such cases. Right? He was really good at these kinds of phrases. And HaChadash Asur Min HaTorah was another example of that type of phrase. Now, where does it come from? So I give you the Mishnah in Orla on the bottom of page 3. This is the origin of this term, HaChadash Asur Min HaTorah. HaChadash Asur Min HaTorah is a play on words. HaChadash does not refer to things that are new. It refers to what halachically, at least in the yeshiva world, they would call Chadash. Right? What is Chadash?
Different.
Okay, grain, it refers to grain, right? New grain, right? That
it's supposed to replace the old grain
exactly, right? This the prohibition, right, against using new grain, right, is part and parcel of the of many of the mitzvos hatluyos ba'aretz, and the Mishnah says that new grain, hachadash, asur min hatara bechol makom, v'ha'orla v'amhalacha, v'akil'ayim midivrei sofrim, that chadash, the isur of using new grain, is an isur min hatorah. It's an isur that comes from the Torah itself. Whereas orla is the prohibition against orla is a prohibition which comes from Kabbalah, right, from tradition, right, and kilayim comes from divrei sofrim. That's a rabbinic enactment. Three different isurim from three different sources. Chadash is min haTorah, orla is halacha, kilayim is midivrei sofrim. That's the origin of this. The first time the Chassam Sofer uses this this principle, he is actually, believe it or not, he uses it, A, in the context of Chadash. He's talking about Chadash. He's not talking about reform. He's not talking about the Hamburg Temple. He's talking about the prohibition against eating Chadash, right, which makes his play on words that much more powerful. And as you'll see, he refers to it with regard to a kula rather than a chumra. Let's look. Turn to the top of page 4. Second line. Likewise. Look how hard they have worked to justify the lenient minhag of eating chadash before the Omer, and it is meant to justify the prevailing custom. Yet one who is pious ought to be careful for himself about such things. And it is sound advice not to be quick in creating what? In creating prohibitions. Let me read that again. Chassam Sofer, heralded as the father of ultra-orthodoxy, writing, what it is sound advice not to be quick in creating prohibitions in Hebrew. Okay, right. In Hebrew, ein lemaher lechadesh isur umikol shekein heter ki minhag Yisrael torahi. Okay, so Yosef, it's a slightly different argument that he's making. Right, he's saying that yes, that Mesorah takes on an important role. Right? And so you shouldn't be quick to create new prohibitions. You certainly shouldn't be quick to create new leniencies. Right? Things that we have, but his point here was that things that, look, something like chadash, nobody observes it today. We all eat chadash. We all find a way to get around it. Okay. And he said, and so you shouldn't be quick, so quick to aser it. Because it's a kula that we've all taken on upon ourselves, and now comes the way to remember this. V'haklal hachadash asur mihatorah b'chol makom v'hayashan umiyushan mishubach mimeno. And here's a general rule: leave things as they are. Don't introduce new prohibitions. Don't introduce new leniencies. In the Torah world, we value the way things have been. They should continue to be that way. And here's a way to remember it: hachadash asur mihatorah b'chol makom. Right? So this was not exactly the clarion call that historians sometimes argue that it was. This is definitely somebody who has a very conservative approach about it. Now, there are places where he did innovate. I don't know if anybody was at Dr. Shapiro's presentation at Kohelet, I guess 2 weeks ago he was here. And I don't know if he mentioned this, but he gave a talk at some point while he was here. He gave a talk on censorship in the Jewish world. And a rather classic case of this is the fact that the Chassam Sofer seems to have written a tshuva early on. One of the great debates of 19th century halacha was the issue of metzitza b'peh. And this was something that became an issue of the Reform community versus the Orthodox community. Metzitza b'peh is the practice of sucking at the wound and a bris mila with one's mouth. And there were a series of famous cases in the mid-19th century. The argument was made that babies were dying because they were getting infected by this practice. And the Chassam Sofer wrote a tshuva that one may use a tube in order to do so. And that tshuva was later argued to be counterfeit, to have been forged, and it was taken out of the standard collections of Chassam Sofer's writing. So Chassam Sofer was not afraid to innovate when necessary. He was not afraid to be makil when necessary. Now, that does not take away from the fact that the Chassam Sofer was indeed an ardent and a vocal opponent of the Reform movement. Some have even gone so far as to say that his presence alone and his sharpness, and again, it was a combination of he knew the halacha better than anybody else, and he would throw these phrases and zingers at anybody who tried to touch him, and he had the force that the Reform movement simply did not have, that in his lifetime, the Reform movement didn't make great strides. Now, again, like I said before, part of that was because the society, the context, the government was not in support of Reform movement. The culture as a whole was in a rather conservative mode during those years, the 1820s, the 1830s. But really until his death in 1839, the Reform movement does not make strong inroads into much of the traditional Jewish community. One quick side note. Anybody know why was the Chassam Sofer particularly interested in this story? If you look at the map that I gave you. I'm sorry, the print is so small, but we'll be able to do this on a screen and you could see it a little better. So the Chassam Sofer, I said, is in Pressburg. If you look at the Empire of Austria, the yellow in the middle of the map, right, if you look at the word of, right to the west of the word of, you see Pressburg. That's where the Chassam Sofer lives. The world of Reform Judaism is nowhere near Pressburg. It is, if you would go north, you can find Berlin, in the Kingdom of Prussia. It was in Berlin, it was in Hamburg, it was in a rather Germanic elements of and culture of Western Europe where the early Reform was happening. There was no Reform synagogue in Pressburg. There was no Reform synagogue anywhere near Pressburg during the Chassam Sofer's life. So why did he have such an interest in what was happening? So part of it is because they had appealed to him, that's for sure. Right? But it was more than that, and I think it went a little deeper. Number one, I think the Chassam Sofer was a man of vision. I think he did see the potential for this to spread and to spread into the Austro-Hungarian Empire and wanted to put an end to it. But if you ever look at a tshuva of the Chassam Sofer, an unedited one, you'll get another clue as to why I think he was so interested in it. As Chassam Sofer signs all of his tshuvot, I didn't give it to you here, but he writes, Moshe HaKatan Sofer, Me Frankfurt de Main. Okay, Chassam Sofer was German. Right? Yes, his professional life was spent in Hungary, right? But he grew up in the German community, and always, I think, identified that way. He signed all of his tshuvos that way, right? Identifying himself as a German. And so what was happening in the German Jewish community, I think, was near and dear to his own heart. Okay. Moving the story forward, though, things will change. Things will change by the 1850s, following the death of the Chasam Sofer and following a very important shift in the political tides of Western and Central Europe. 1848 is probably the most important year in modern history that nobody knows. Right? Why? What happened in 1848? Huh? Yes, right? Failed revolutions throughout Europe. Right? Socialist revolutions throughout Europe, and we don't know about them because most of them failed. Right? Well, they all failed, actually. Right? But Europe was a tumultuous state in 1848. That is, whereas post-Napoleon, so the conservative government seemed to begin to circle the wagons and try to take a stronger control over what was happening, and then, as often happens, for every action there's a reaction, and then the liberal sentiment in Europe will burst out in 1848, particularly clinging to ideas of socialism, begin to revolt against the establishment. Most of them are able to be put down, but as a result, governments will begin to shift their policies in order to make their states more open and receptive to more liberal types of ideas. This will begin to create an avenue and a pathway for the reform movement to begin to creep in and get support in places that it hadn't previously. At the same time, the students of the Chasam Sofer are making a geographic move. They're moving from the areas around Pressburg to the areas farther to the east in the Carpathian Mountains, areas that the cities that you're probably most familiar with are the cities that later become Hasidic, that had already become Hasidic homes like Munkach, who else is out there? Satmar, absolutely, right? Those are Hungarian cities in the Carpathian Mountains. You begin to have actually a really interesting alliance between students of the Chasam Sofer who are not coming from a Hasidic background at all, but from a more traditional yeshiva type of upbringing in the yeshiva of Pressburg, moving, taking positions out in what was known as the Unterland. The Unterland means the lowlands. Only Jews would do this and call places of higher elevation the Unterland, but it is a Jewish term to refer to. It was invented by sort of the more Germanic-speaking members of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, those who lived on the Austrian side, in areas like Vienna, that saw the areas of the Carpathian Mountains as culturally low, even if topographically they were not low. So the students of the Chasam Sofer begin to take positions there. They begin to be allied with some of these emerging Hasidic dynasties, and we begin to notice a shift in the type of language that's being used in the halachic writing of these students. So one example I brought you here on page 4, Rabbi Yisrael David Margolius Yaffe, it's a long name, wrote a compilation of tshuvos known as a response of tshuvos Mecholas HaMachanayim. This entire set of tshuvos is dedicated to issues of changes in Judaism due to modernity. Changes in Jewish practice as a result of modernity. So here's one example. Siman Aleph, Bom Mivor, Kama Lo Sases, Chayav, Hamidameh Be'avodas, Das Yisrael, L'Sha'arei Hadatos, Be'eze Minhag, V'nimus, Milavush, Onigun. So Siman number one will explain how many prohibitions are violated by one who, in the context of Jewish worship, imitates the Gentiles to any degree in either dress or melody. Question of the youth. And now, is it proper for us to make the ways of our Torah similar as possible to those of the nation in whose midst we reside? Because only this way we will find favor in their eyes. Right? This is what we talked about. Right? This was true sentiment, right, that was felt on the street, that we need to make ourselves more similar to them in dress, in architecture, in decorum, so that we will find favor. This is what the Mechalas HaMachanayim is responding to. Right? Ki ach bezot meot lanu liyot letifer beinayim. That's the question. Okay, here's the answer. And given that such is the law, even one whose intent is not to imitate the Gentiles, due to the fact that he transgresses many prohibitions, must risk endangering his life rather than transgress. What's the Hebrew phrase for that? Yehareg v'al yavor. Rather than dress or sound like a Gentile, Yehareg v'al yavor, let yourself be killed rather than transgress something of that sort. But now God loves to advocate for the children of Israel, and therefore we must find some means of arguing that the present generation has not, in fact, violated one of the cardinal sins about which we say be killed and do not transgress. That is, this is what we would call the Havamina. His Havamina is that doing anything of the sort, dressing like a non-Jew, listening to music of a non-Jew, would be Yahareg v'al Yavor, would be something that you should have given your life up for instead of transgressing. Now he's going to try to find a way out. And behold, there's a way to escape the conclusion that one should be killed rather than transgress by citing that which states that in cases of activities in which aid idol worship, the law requires one to be killed rather than transgress due to the fear that one will come to engage in idol worship itself. Thus, such is the law only when the prohibited substance, the idol or its equivalent, is actually in front of him. But in cases of imitating the Gentiles, the prohibited substance is not before him, and thus it might not be considered an activity which aids idol worship. And therefore, the law might not require one to be killed rather than transgress, but nonetheless, we must protest with all our might, for it is explicitly prohibited by the Torah. There's a dramatic shift here. And there's a dramatic shift from the writings of Chassam Sofer, in which he's writing Hakadash Asur Min HaTorah, right, as a, not as a halachic statement, as a pithy, right, way of remembering, hey, guys, Minhag Yisrael hi. This is our tradition. This is our Masorah. We ought to hold on to this. In any event, whether it's Kulas or Homers you're trying to introduce, we're not so fast to change. A generation later, his students are introducing the language that doing something that looks or feels like what the Gentiles around you are doing might actually be something you have to give up your own life for, right? rather than transgress. In 1864... Sorry, I skipped a little bit. Let's go back to our timeline. Halfway through the sheet, 1839 to 1850, Ramosha Sofer dies. Students migrate toward the Unjalan. 1848 is our failed socialist revolutions. In 1850, a man by the name of Samson Raphael Hirsch is selected as the rabbi of the Orthodox community in Frankfurt. In 1851, a man by the name of Yisrael Hildesheimer is selected as the rabbi in Eisenstadt, Hungary. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer's story we're going to tell next time. However, what's important to know is that in 1864, the Hungarian government, now more open to liberal influences, has taken up the question, it's considering starting a state-sponsored rabbinical seminary. Now, why would the Hungarian government want to do that?
Co-opted and
controlled. Exactly. Right? If I can run it, if I can fund it, then I can control what gets taught in it. And I can make sure that Jews now and rabbis will get proper training, they will learn the language of our country, right? They will stop with some of their more outlandish types of practices and superstitions. If I fund it, I can control it. And so this was not, this idea first was hatched in Tsarist Russia in the 1840s. So now in the 1860s, the idea has been brought up, and there are factions of the Jewish community who are supporting this idea. The leading candidate to run such an institution would have been Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. In response to that, a bunch of rabbis in Eastern Hungary get together. A man by the name of Hillel Lichtenstein is the one who organizes it, and they come out with a series of statements that they want the rabbinic establishment of Hungary to sign on to, as a statement of creed, a statement of where they believe Jews ought to be, and particularly responding to the possibility that somebody other than one of their own will come and run this new state-sponsored rabbinical assembly. The Psak Din of Michalovce, 1867. Number one, it is prohibited to give a drasha in the languages of the nations of the world. And likewise, it is prohibited to listen to a drasha in the languages of the nations of the world. Thus, any Jew who hears a rabbi or anyone else sermonize in a Gentile language must leave the synagogue and go outside. The sermonizer must sermonize in the Jewish language spoken by all kosher Jews of this country. Number two, it is prohibited to enter for the purposes of prayer into a synagogue which does not have a bima in the middle. What is that a reference to?
The reform movement.
Exactly, right? The reform movement, one of the early battles was moving the bima from the middle up to the front of the shul. And why did people want it up in the front? Because churches have an altar, right, at the front of the synagogue. The Chassam Sofer has a long tshuva on this, prohibiting the move of the bima from the middle to the front. Number three, it is likewise prohibited to enter a synagogue with a tower. Why?
A tower,
looked like a church steeple. It is prohibited to make clothing for the Shaliach Tzibor and cantors in a way that resembles that of other religions. It is prohibited to make the mechitza, which separates men from women, in any way which does not completely preclude the men from seeing the women, as it was done in the past. And likewise, if it is already built, one may not enter into it. Six, it is prohibited to listen to the tefillot of a choir and a fortiori to pray with them, or to answer Amen after them, even if it is therefore for if he is therefore forced to pray alone. That is better to daven biyichidus than to daven with a choir. It is prohibited to enter synagogues known as horshuls, choir shuls, as it says in the Gemara Shabbos. Rabbi Tarfon said, even if a man is chasing him in order to kill him, or a snake is running to bite him, he should not enter a house of idol worship and not houses such as these, etc. Number eight, it is prohibited to make a chuppah in a synagogue. They shall only be under the sky. Number nine, it is prohibited to change any Jewish custom or any manner of the synagogue which was received from our fathers and our fathers' fathers. Okay. What do you notice about this list?
They were pretty scared.
Huh?
They were pretty scared. They were like...
They were scared. Why were they more scared now?
Because they didn't have the Chassam Sofer to be that person to follow.
And what was happening as a result?
They were getting misled.
Then something else was happening. What happened in 1864? What's happening in 1864?
They're getting
okay, so they're beginning to encroach, right, on Austro-Hungarian land. Now, the Chassam Sofer was all a vision. It was, yeah, maybe, if we don't put this down, right, they may encroach upon our lands. Now, a man by the name of Rasviel Hildesheimer is a rabbi in Eisenstadt, in Hungary. Now, the government is actually talking about a state-sponsored rabbinical seminary, which is not going to be this rabbinical seminary that Hillel Lichtenstein and other students of the Chassam Sofer would have approved of. So now it's real. Now we're in the thick of the battle. And now our language and the tone, everything changes. Because now we're in the middle of a fight. Now we're fighting the fight. What else is missing? What is the genre of this statement, of this piece?
Asur, asur, asur.
And what's not there?
Winter.
Winter clearly isn't there, but what else isn't there? Is this a tshuva?
Well, there's no question. They're coming out.
There's no question, there's also no
answer. No, well,
it's a declaration.
It's a declaration, right? There's no reasoning given. There's no sources given, right? The one source, the Gemara and Brachos, isn't quite,
It's
psak. And that's what they called it. Psak din. Right? Because when we're in the midst of the battle, I'm not going to give you an excursus, right, and 30 sources as to why this is Asur. It's Asur. You can't do it. We got to fight the fight, right, because it's here now. It's real. And we have to give them the benefit of the doubt. Right? The world of Hungarian Jewry did not have the ability to see 200 years down the line to Bala Cynwyd, right, Pennsylvania, and say, you know, it's going to be okay. Right, Jews will go, you know, so they'll take in a little bit of modern clothing and some modern music, right, and they're going to continue to go to shul on Shabbos. There was no way of knowing that. Right? What they saw was that Judaism, Torah, was in danger. And this response is a response of a people who believed that Judaism was in mortal danger, and they needed to fight back with everything they had, and they fight, the fight is quick, and it has to be that everybody understands this. Every simple milkman, right, living in Hungary, in the Carpathian Mountains, has to understand exactly what we're saying. Asur. Bechomik, it's Asur. You can't do it, you can't come close, right, because they're afraid of where it would lead. The Maharam Shik was one of the great students, probably the preeminent student of the Chassam Sofer, writes the following in 1866. I received your letter from a week ago in which you sought advice regarding the fact that your wife and 10 children depend on your livelihood, which is earned through teaching the Beit Midrash, Beit Midrash in your town, where they have begun to introduce innovations like placing a bima on the eastern wall, and a choir and a ganter, and clothes like the Gentiles wear. And even though you thought it was bad to date, you have not left your position, despite the fact that it requires you on occasion to go into the sanctuary and pray, you determined it was permissible due to the need to support yourself and your family. And now you heard that several rabbis and dayanim published a severe prohibition against such a synagogue and choir, that's what we just read, right? And that its severity is worse than eating pig, and there is a possibility that it may constitute a cardinal sin about which they say be killed rather than transgress. And however it turns out, I urge you to gird your loins like a warrior and to unabashedly proclaim in front of your employers who introduce these innovations that according to what we just explained, these things are prohibited for a Jew, and woe is to the one who transgresses even a minor prohibition for the sake of his livelihood, even if it means he has to beg. And he may not pray in the synagogue with the choir, even if on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. He has to travel to the outlying towns or beyond. The righteous must be strong. And God will not forsake those who faithfully trust in him. The true believers of Israel must be strong and resolved to uphold the institutions of old and to publicize the Torah and its true beliefs, and to fight against the rebels and give it over to our children after us as we received it from our children. And Hashem will reward him and all others who stand in the breach. Signed with blessings in regard, Moshe Shik from Bratislava, right, or Presburg. By the 1860s, a man by the name of Rabbi Akiva Yosef Schlesinger emerges as the leader of this community. He writes a book that is actually a commentary on the last will and testament of the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer, it was what we call ethical will. An ethical will, or directions you give to the next generation. Chassam Sofer wrote such a piece. Right? It's a kind of a small musar work. By the 1860s, as this community was coalescing, now they're going to turn back to the Chassam Sofer and point to him as the forefather of this movement. He, after all, is the one who said, HaKadosh Asur Min HaTorah. HaKadosh Asur Min HaTorah in the 1860s means something very different than it did in 1880 when he first wrote it. But they can trace some of them, their lineage, back to him. And he was their original forefather. So what better way to make that connection than to write a commentary on the actual words of the Chassam Sofer? And so that's this book called Lev HaIvri. This is the last source that we'll read. Rabbi Yosef Schlesinger says as follows. And changing any of our father's customs, even if it entails no resemblance to the practices of the Gentiles, or any other prohibition, nonetheless, to change from that which was received from our fathers is completely prohibited. That is, again, to change anything, even if it doesn't look like what the Gentiles are doing. But it's a change. Hachadash, under any circumstances, asur min haTorah. And know that anything which is done in order to change the customs of Israel so that they should resemble the way in which the Gentiles worship, he transgresses several negative commandments. And it is more severe than eating pig in quality and quantity. In quantity, eating an olive's worth of pig is only one negative commandment. Changing and switching customs in order to resemble those of the Gentiles transgresses many negative transgressions. In quality, because these negative commandments of resembling the Gentile are an aid to idol worship, and there is a possibility that it might fall under the category of die and do not transgress. And it is a great sin to make a tower on a synagogue. Besides the great sin of resemblance to the practice of the Gentiles, for which one transgresses 7 negative commandments and 2 positive commandments, it is also a rebellion against God and the public desecration of his name, and there is virtually no atonement. And similarly, sometimes they seduce by saying, just as one is required to fulfill his obligation to God, so too he is required to fulfill his obligation to man. And Tov Torah im Derech Eretz.
He's saying you shouldn't say Totar and Darakharetz. He's saying
no, this is what the seducers say. The seducers say, right?
That's what I meant. The seducers are saying you can't do this because of Totar and Darakharetz. He's saying don't listen to that.
Exactly. So now let's just stop there then. Okay, good. So here was my question. Here's the question that I want to leave you with. Right? And you kind of have the answer already.
Yeah.
Right? These things that they're railing against, dressing like the Gentiles, music of the Gentiles, choirs. When were these issues in the Reform movement? These are the aesthetic reforms of the late 18th century, early 19th century. Old news! What's the Reform movement doing in the 1860s? They've broken with halakha completely! They've already said that we can go back and change things. We don't have to believe in a return to design anymore. We don't have to believe in a Mashiach anymore. And they're well beyond that. Why are they railing against these things in the 1860s that were issues in the 18-teens and the 1820s? The answer is they're not. The emergence of ultra-Orthodoxy in Eastern Hungary in the 1850s and 1860s was not a response to the rise of the Reform movement. It was a response to those who were saying Tov Torah im Derech Eretz. In other words, it was a response to who? Samson Rayfield Hirsch, the Neo-Orthodox community, whose story we will tell next time. Thank you.